May it please the court. My name is David Furlow, and I am here today on behalf of Carl Pruitt and National American Insurance Company. Before I get into my two-pronged analysis of how the first court of appeals went wrong in this case, I would like to the court's indulgence for a moment so that I can place these bail bond issues in their real-world context. The bail bonds that are the subject of this appeal are instruments that have been determined to be available to defendants by a magistrate and a peace officer. It is important to understand that these bail bonds are not available to people who are considered to be no bond defendants in the city in Harris County. That is, they are not available to habitual defendants, to capital offense defendants, to persons indicted before a grand jury but not arrested, to any defendant out already on a felony bond, according to Kathy Braddock. That's Clerk's Record 3 at pages 570 and at pages 138 to 139. Not available to anyone who is a defendant with a pending motion to revoke probation, motion to revoke deferred adjudication, motion to revoke parole. Not available to anybody in a case involving family violence. That's parental violence towards a child, spousal violence.
That seems to take a big bite out of their argument. Well, what do you have left?
Yes, Your Honor, in fact, I've even got a few more examples just to show you how limited it is, the issues that we examine today. Don't involve cases involving any situation where a victim has requested emergency release under the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure to protect that person from a threat of imminent violence. And that's in Clerk's Record 3, page 139. They don't include cases in which the police officer has determined that there is a danger of that there is danger or risk of flight and have therefore obtained a 2B, what's known as a pocket warrant. Those things are not before you today. What's also not before you today are matters of sealed indictments. Those are not matters of public record. So we take this entire category of all of these dangerous and likely flight risk defendants and move them out of the oral argument today. Because what we're actually talking about, for the most part, are misdemeanor offenses and citizens determined to be entitled to post a bail bond by a magistrate and a peace officer.
Well, some of them are felons. Some of them are felons.
Some of them have, Your Honor, but it's significant in Harris County because, Justice Brisker, we know that there are tens of thousands of letters issued every year by the Sheriff's Department to our fellow citizens who have been determined to be of such little danger that the sheriff himself says, you've got a pending warrant, and it would behoove you to get a bail bondsman or an attorney and go and post a bond yourself. Now, I would suggest to you, Justice Brister, that the bail bondsman, by assisting Sergeant Hall and the other people in the warrants division, actually help them and give them an opportunity of raising the response level above the minimal 10% response that they get from those letters to a much higher level. And when those citizens, our fellow citizens, go out there and actually post that arrest bond, they're actually making life safer for our police officers, because that means that those police officers don't have to go and serve a warrant in a dangerous neighborhood where coming into a situation to serve a warrant exposes them to the threat of attack or a shooting.
But there was testimony presented that some defendant had been tipped off and that occasionally this is a problem. There's a subset in here that can be a problem or a danger to an arresting officer. How would you carve out that subset?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that Charles Backeries, our district clerk, already carved out that set because the tip-off issue that you're referring to is the one that appeared in the blue, the one they discussed. And that occurred in 2000, and on July 7th of 2000, that's when our district clerk, Backeries, imposed the 48-hour rule. And let me emphasize also, with respect to that, every time that these sheriff's officers or policemen determine that it's time to go out and get a warrant, and they put this into the GEM system, they've got a 48-hour window during which that information is not public record, and that's in response to the tip-off. So that tip-off situation where someone received notice shortly after the issuance of the arrest, and that's specifically Officer Sharon Harwell's story, first of all, that won't occur today because those officers have 48 hours from the time that they actually go out there and put this in the system to go out and get that person arrested. But second, Your Honor, I would say that with respect to that particular instance, I'm not going to blame the bail bondsman because the testimony is that Sharon Ballard called up the father accused of raping his own daughter and confronted him about that in order to build his case. And that's when the man told her on the phone, according to her own deposition, her testimony at the temporary injunction hearing, that in response to what the police officer said, he said, and forgive me for using the blunt language, but he said, "I'll take the lying bitch and go to Mexico. You'll never catch me." The response, him leaving, was in response to what the police officer told him. And there's no proof anywhere in this record of it actually having been caused, of him actually fleeing and then being caught later in the day, that that actually resulted from a bail bonds and tip-off. So I reject the state's attempt to mischaracterize the evidence and to suggest that a bail bond is responsible for that unfortunate event when it was in fact a police officer. Now, the 48 hours does in fact address that situation. But there's plenty of other ways in this record. Our Code of Criminal Procedure talks about ways in which emergency orders can be imposed in order to protect the victims of crime and witnesses of crime. And in fact, the no bond list includes anybody who's requested that emergency relief. Again, according to Kathy Braddock, in the clerk's record, volume 3, pages 138, and specifically at 139. You'll find that in there, which is talking about that. But there's other opportunities, too. These police officers can go, and they can get that 2B warrant. And as long as that pocket warrant remains in the pocket, it doesn't go into the gym system, and they have an opportunity to serve it at that leisure. Ditto for the sealed indictment. So for the tiny minority of potential danger, there are plenty of alternatives available that don't require us to muzzle Carl Pruitt's mouth or to steal the pen when he and other independent bondsmen will write letters. And I would submit to you that those letters and those phone calls actually do us good, because every citizen who is found to be entitled by a peace officer, by a magistrate, to post a bond who actually does so, saves our taxpaying dollars, because we don't have to pay for them to be fed, housed, and guarded in Harris County jails. So it's to our benefit that Carl Pruitt and other independent bondsmen do send out those notice letters based that are truthful and accurate and based on public record information. And it is against public policy and against the Open Records Act for the Harris County Bail Bond Board to shut down those avenues, those unique avenues of truthful, communicative information that is the equivalent of media information, where people like Paul Pruitt, in fact, are transmitting that. And it's
even
beneficial.
If 3702 doesn't apply, even if it doesn't, why isn't that a reason? Don't call between 9 p.m. and 9 a.m. How can you defend calling at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Very simply, Ron, because I'm the father of a teenage son and a teenage daughter. And my son gets picked up on a theft of check and failure to return a videotape charge by some police officer who reads his name off of the warrant. I don't want to have to wait for 24 hours that you impose this 9 prohibition for up to 36 hours, 24 plus 12. I don't want to have to wait that long to get my son or daughter out of Harris County Jail. And as Ms. Kathy Braddock, the assistant district attorney I used to work with in the Harris County District Attorney's Office, testified to me in the temporary injunction here, jail is a bad place. And I don't want my son or daughter as a teenager to be exposed to situations.
So you no longer get a phone call when you get arrested. You got to count on the bail bond industry to contact your parents.
Usually, Your Honor, we do get phone calls, not if you've got call blocker or caller ID or those other things that the Deputy Sheriff Shepherd testified will block people from getting phone calls. So if you've got call blocker and you've got a teenager, you may not hear from them unless you hear from a bail bondsman whose number won't appear on call blocker because it's not coming from a public phone. And that's a serious concern, and it was addressed and it was developed in the testimony below. But I would submit, Justice Heck, the reason it's so important is because if you do spend time in Harris County Jail, as Ms. Braddock admitted, there is a real possibility, first, that you may get beaten up, second, that you might be raped, and that you might be exposed to AIDS, or on a lesser matter, if you weren't physically assaulted, you're in jail with a number of people who are drug addicts and sometimes prostitutes, and you may be exposed to tuberculosis or any of the other diseases that occur whenever you have a group of people closely confined quarters. So I would submit to you that people have very good reasons for wanting to avoid going to jail, and most importantly, for wanting to get little Johnny or little Jenny out of jail as quickly as possible after they've been placed in there.
Are Johnny and Jenny going to get one phone call?
Johnny and Jenny will get one phone call.
Won't they call that?
The phone call if I've got caller ID. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Won't they call Dad?
Presumably, they will call Dad. And if Dad is speaking at a seminar up in New York City, then they remain in jail. If Dad has got caller ID on the system or call blocker to block out phone calls from public phones, then I don't get any word at all. And they remain there until they manage to call somebody else or until a bail bondsman notifies them. Quickest word I'd like them to get is from a bail bondsman. And that bail bondsman also gives me the pertinent information about how I can actually use the system. And most importantly, and consistently with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Virginia Pharmacy Board versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, that provides me with truthful, accurate information about competitively priced products. Because you see, these restrictions, the reason there's no at enactment statement of purposes, the reason there's no legislative history here or in the federal bail bond case that Judge Hoyt decided, is because these bonds reflect not a real call from the from people concerned for the police or for the public, but from International Fidelity Insurance Corporation's desire to create little islands of non-competition and protect its people by carving out exceptions that undermine the stated purpose for the rules, that is, the exceptions for existing business relationships and prior to existing business relationships. If any call, any threat of a tip-off is such a great danger to the police and the public, why then are there exceptions carved out for the existing business relationship bonds? Does his customer not pose the same sort of threat? Are there any records, surveys, studies, statistics, analysis by this bail bond board in which it compared the existing business relationship bondsman, who probably has a repeat criminal for a client, versus the ordinary business bondsman, the independent business bondsman, is trying to serve the needs of a largely misdemeanor public who are often having their very first sad experience in the jail? I would submit to you that there is an absence of record there. Now,
courts have upheld restrictions on attorney solicitation of clients for a fee. And how are rules 24 and 25 different?
Very simple, Your Honor, because it's Mr. Pruitt and his direct employees subject to his control who are making calls to provide people with truthful, informational, non-misleading information. They are not, as John O'Quinn was, employing runners. Of course, the John O'Quinn case this court heard, some of whom apparently may have dressed up as priests in order to bring in business. There you had a record that reflected real concerns about misleading the public, fraud, and demeaning the legal profession. Here you have none of those matters taking forward. You have certainly truthful, non-misleading information about a constitutionally protected right.
So restrictions on lawyers are okay because all lawyers are bad, but restrictions on bail bondsmen are okay because everybody knows bail bondsmen are upright citizens.
No, Judge Brister, I would never try
to follow your argument.
But what I'm just saying is there was a record of abuses and of misleading information and of problems where there were, in fact, runners who were outside the lawyer's control, where you had conduct running cases for compensation that you don't have precedent in this case. I would also submit, however, and the Kaczynski article that we cited there, pointed out the fact that the Supreme Court has carved out a special area of bar regulation because of the unique position of attorneys as officers of the court and of counsel. So the bail bond cases are put off in a completely different category from the lawyer disciplinary rules cases that this court has heard before. They're different matters. The important things I would like to address here is, let me address Justice Heck's concern with respect to 3702. Specifically, bail bonds are unique three-way contracts between the state, the defendant, and the bondsman in an amount preset by the state. And so what you actually have there is something that falls outside of 3702, which deals with two-way transactions between a seller, say, of timeshare units and a purchaser of timeshare units. Here, these three-way matters are matters in which the state, through a magistrate and an assistant district attorney, have determined the amount of the bond. And that takes us over to Section 3702B2, which says that a consumer telephone call is not subject to subsection A if the call is made, number two, primarily in connection with an existing debt or contract for which payment or performance has not been made. Well, the obligation of the contract, the potential debt, is the bond that someone has to say that they are prepared to pay if they don't show up for the court date. That's the pre-existing matter, because you have a unique three-way contractual relationship between the state, the defendant, and the bondsman. And this is not some sort of bearer bond that I get to take home and cash in. This is a court order that remains with the court that reflects my obligation to appear on the date that they called me to appear. And that's where you get into, for example, Jefferson County versus Stirk.
Mr. Furlow, your time has expired. Are there any further questions? You can continue on rebuttal. And the court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Ms. Hoshin and Mr. Becker will present arguments for the respondent. Ms. Hoshin will open for the first 10 minutes.
Hey, please, my name is Sandra Hoshin. I represent the Harris County Bail Bond Board. This case concerns challenges to two rules passed by the board which provide temporary restrictions on solicitation by bondsmen. The rules have been challenged on the basis of the board's authority as well as the constitutionality. In my 10 minutes before the court, I'd like to focus on two issues that were brought in the briefing. The first is, was the evidence properly before the court to establish the substantial public interest that the board sought to address to satisfy the First Amendment? And the second, were the board's interests sufficiently addressed in Rule 25 to satisfy First Amendment concerns contrary to what was found by the court below?
Do you agree that this case does not involve misleading statements?
No, we're not saying that there's misleading statements. Our opponents urge that the absence of enactment statements or a record of evidence of intent before the promulgation of these rules means there was no evidence at all of substantial interest for adoption of these rules. Well, first of all, we disagree that there wasn't evidence, but second of all, we disagree with this statement of law. In this connection, I need to mention to the court that there was a brief filed last Thursday, a letter brief by our opponent, that cites an 11th Circuit case suggesting this is recent controlling authority on this issue to suggest that you can't consider anything at the trial on the issue concerning the intent of the rulemaking body. In making citation to this, though, I need to mention that he fails to cite a very recent case by the 5th Circuit that was decided this last August, Fantasy Ranch versus City of Arlington. I'd like to discuss that case first. In that case, there was an Arlington rule that was adopted for SOBs that prohibited certain actions in proximity to nude dancers to better prevent touching between nude dancers and patrons. Fantasy had filed suit challenging the ordinance under the First Amendment. And in evaluating the substantial interest element under the First Amendment, the court discussed what evidence it could consider. And relying on the United States Supreme Court, Almeida and Renton, the court held that a municipality may rely on any evidence that is reasonably believed to be relevant for demonstrating a connection between speech and a substantial independent interest. In this connection, the court noted there was evidence supporting the city's rationale for its ordinance from an expert report, several studies, as well as data cited in court opinions. Fantasy argued, however, that there was no empirical evidence for the city's ordinance pre-enactment and pointed to expert statements that he was unaware of any empirical studies correlating distance issue pre-enactment. The Fifth Circuit responded to this by saying that the focus on pre-enactment rationale is misplaced, since our appropriate focus is not empirical inquiry into the actual intent of the enacting legislature, but rather the existence of a current governmental interest. In this record, there was sufficient evidence of current interests.
Well, let's talk about that, because opposing counsel said that the subset that really is at issue here, that is a subject of the interest that is the point of concern, is so small as to really be negligible. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think it's so small. We have testimony in the record. Primarily, you can look at a lot of the testimony from Kathy Braddock, which starts in the clerk's record, volume 3, about page 560 to 620 or something. She talks about a lot of the problems that the board became aware of concerning, for example, with our problem under Rule 24, the issue of tipping off officers. And in fact, it became such a prevalent problem that it was in a newspaper, and also Jim's responded, our district clerk is an independent authority, responded by having the 48-hour rule with respect to Jim's.
Well, what about the argument that there are a whole lot of categories of people that really this shouldn't address? I mean, the misdemeanors, all the people who have other means of getting this information.
You know, the officers provided testimony in connection with this as well, and I don't think that it matters what type, if a crime's been committed, a misdemeanor, whatever, there's always a safety concern. You know, I recall recently in Houston we had, you know, there was a situation where someone's just, you know, stopping someone for a, you know, for a violation of traffic and was in danger.
Well, so but this sort of conjures up the peanut butter presidential motorcade analogy. That just because something has the potential to be dangerous doesn't mean you can ban it.
Right.
And it sounds like what you're saying is there may be some potential in some odd case or two, but it's not a pervading problem.
Well, it was discussed with the board as being a very real danger, a real danger to the officers on the tipping off issue. And because of that, the bail bond board has a unique relationship with the bondsman in that it does have a kind of a shepherding responsibility of this profession, much like we have a responsibility in our rules that we adopt for judges and for lawyers. And in doing that, they need to be responsible to the public in ensuring that the way they conduct their activities is not a risk to the public. So when they found that something that they are doing is a risk to the public, it was their responsibility, by virtue of their responsibilities in doing this particular activity, to respond.
So if one out of 50,000 people who were stopped for a traffic violation turned violent on an arrest, that's enough to justify the prohibition?
Well, you know, you are talking about a safety risk to officers that could be alleviated by this rule. So then the question is that a substantial interest for the public and for this board to consider? And I think it is. I think any time there's danger to an officer, and in addition, you might want to consider that there's not just that kind of danger, as there is also the danger under...
Their job's inherent in nature.
I'm sorry?
Their job is inherent in nature. It's not a free zone out there where you can go do your job without the risk of being harmed. So your analysis, in my opinion, is flawed to say that it's a danger for them to go do this. Everything they do is a danger.
Well, in the tipping off situation, there is a danger to the officer. At least that is what we discovered from talking with different officers. But in addition,
Do we have concrete examples of that where it actually happened? How many do we have?
I don't know that we have an exact number. We just have the discussions from the different officers.
Hundreds or dozens or one or two?
You know, I don't believe that it was ever quantified a number. But I do think that I think common sense would also tell us that there is going to be more of a risk if someone is aware that they're about to be arrested, and especially in a domestic violence situation.
Well, there's no question about that, but we've got to evaluate competing interests here. The First Amendment interest has got a considerable weight to be given to it. And so I was just wondering, are we talking about in the abstract officers could get hurt, or has one ever been hurt?
Well, I think that the danger has been what's been discussed, about them knowing that they were about to be to be arrested.
So the answer is the evidence. You're not familiar with a case in the record where an officer was hurt by the tipping off.
No, I'm not. But I am also aware that, you know, early on in this case, there was an amicus brief filed by David Crum, and it's talking about the discussion of people that are in domestic violence situations. And, of course, then the tipping off in that situation also brings a fear of danger to those who might be doing the reporting that is the subject of the arrest, also the destruction of evidence, which is a real risk. And, you know, these are common sense things that would be involved in the possibility of an arrest occurring.
Did the 48-hour shutdown, whatever it is, on Jim's, did that help or not?
I don't know that that was ever quantified. In the second issue that we...
Well, let me just go back. It seems to me one of the problems here is the exception for those with a prior or existing business relationship,
mm-hmm.
and I guess Rule 24 with an existing business relationship. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and the Court of Appeals held, that exception can really swallow the rule. If the danger is tipping off, you're carving out a whole group of people who are free to tip off perhaps the most violent offenders because they're repeat offenders.
existing relationships, and that would be people that already have a bond with that person. They're not going to be likely to tip them off because they know that if they run, then there is a potential, and this, there's also discussion about this from Kathy Braddock, that there's a potential that they would, you know, take off and then they lose their interest in their bond. So the risk of that in an existing situation isn't very high. Turning to the 24 and 25, the prior and existing relationship, now, that's not a tip.
Is any of that quantified? Is there testimony on any of that?
You know, this is a social area of law, just like it would be with solicitation, with attorneys. You're not going to be able to quantify everything exactly. This is a social science. This is dealing with issues that are not ones that you can easily quantify with numbers. You just know about risk. You use your common sense. I'm sorry, I see that I'm just about out of time, and I did ask, allow the intervener to have time in this case as well. The
court will hear from Mr. Beck.
I'm sorry?
The court then will hear from Mr. Beck.
May it please the court, I am Douglas Becker with Gray and Becker here in Austin. Your Honors, these commercial speech cases, to me, depend very heavily on the record, and I commend this record to you as a full statement that explains, I think, all of the questions that have been asked.
Well, we've been hearing a lot of speculation about the record and no concrete examples, so maybe you can help us with that.
Yes, sir. Well, with respect to officer safety, there's two things, at least, that you need to know. One is this ordinance was not lightly passed. There started to be complaints about these calls from bail bondsmen, from citizens, and from police officers who felt threatened.
Well, I don't like telemarketers, but I didn't know I could complain and we could shut them down. If I knew that, I might have complained a lot earlier. But it seems to me that just because people are complaining doesn't mean that you can impinge upon First Amendment rights without good reason.
That's correct, Your Honor. You can't shut it down just on the basis of the complaint, but the test is established in Central Hudson, and it's plain that you can shut them down. There's a substantial interest. You have a rule that directly advances it, and that there's a reasonable fit, not least restrictive means, but reasonable fit between the regulation and what you're trying to do. I'm appalled to hear that there's any doubt in this record about these rules increasing the safety of police officers. At trial, Mr. Furlow repeatedly said, and it's true, there's not been a single police officer killed trying to execute an arrest warrant after a bail bondsman tipped somebody off. However, there are 6-8 police officers who testified at trial, and in addition, because of summary judgment evidence, I think 9 affidavits properly before you. I recall one off the top of my head from a DPS officer that resulted in a shootout because of a tip-off. And all of those affidavits from the police officers, I don't think can do anything but lead ineluctably to the conclusion that this is going to increase officer safety. They're all of that opinion. And
what about the tip-off from someone with an existing relationship?
There was a lot of evidence about that. First of all, as to the extent of it, the industry representatives, Roger Moore, who's general counsel for my clients, and Jerry Watson, the president, Mr. Moore testified that there would be very few people with existing warrants out there, less than 3 or 4%. Mr. Watson, who'd been in the business longer, said it would be closer to 0 than to 3 or 4%. It's a small number. But why is it okay if there are any? The reason is the bail bondsman has a substantial financial investment in his existing bond. And the testimony at trial is the bail bondsman knows his client. He knows which ones. He knows the family. He knows how long they've been in the community. He knows the whole life story. That's his business to know that. Otherwise, he's not going to make any money writing bonds. So when we get a second charge on someone, the bail bondsman knows, if I tell this person to come in and we'll take care of the second charge, that will be okay. There's testimony that there are bail bondsmen who knew that the second charge was likely to make the person they bonded run. And in those cases, the bail bondsman will call the person into the office or to the police station on a pretense and have them arrested on the second charge, thereby preventing liability on the existing bond. So there is a support in the record for the existing bond exception.
What about the prior exception?
Okay. The prior exception applies not in the safety situation. Yes, ma'am. Just in the middle of the night harassment situation. And the justification there is simply, I think, a numerical one. In other words, there is the prior relationship will also, that bondsman will also know what the situation is, but that bondsman is, there's going to be a small number of people with prior existing relationships. There's a very small number of people, well, among all those people who are arrested, there's not many that have gone to more than a bonding company or two. So we're talking about there was testimony in the middle of the night, 20 to 40 calls, phone calls at home, invading the privacy of the home in a 24-hour period. And those phone calls for people that had a prior or existing relationship would go down to one or two.
Do you think the three-way nature of the bail bonding relationship precludes this being subject to 3702?
Court of Appeals, I think, said yes. I don't know whether it's subject to it or not, to tell you the truth. There's a good argument to be made that it's not. But whether it is or it isn't, if you throw out these regulations, you cast serious doubt on the Business and Commerce Code and also on the FTC regulations that have the identical exceptions for prior or existing relationships. And all of those bodies have felt that they were worthy of some degree of protection. You know, I really want to impress on you that the Bail Bond Board studied all of this for years, starting in late 1997. They didn't just pass this overnight. And they also tried other means to solve this problem. They tried, at first, Kathy Braddock said she thought there was a leak in the district attorney's office because there were so many complaints from police officers. They found that wasn't true. They tried voluntary compliance for a while, and that didn't work. They tried other means, blocking out information, blocking the gym system. What they found was the 48-hour rule, the gym system, wasn't working. It was inconsistent. It wasn't consistently applied. It was subject to change at any time. And then I also...
Should they do away with it?
The gym system?
On the 48-hour life.
Well, it's up to the district clerk.
I understand that, but would it help or hurt?
There were conversations with the district clerk to try to get him to change the system in a way that would be more protective. He's an independent elected official, and that's what he was willing to do. And there's testimony in the record that it was very inconsistent and ineffective, even to this day. So there was a feeling that these rules had to be passed, and that they would do real good. All the officers testified that they would, and in fact they have. We really know for a fact they've done good, because Kathy Braddock testified that after these rules were passed, complaints from citizens fell 80% to 90%, and complaints from police officers also fell drastically. So we don't have to guess whether this effectively addressed the problem. The record reflects that it addressed the problem. And there are alternate means. The phone calls in the jail, there's testimony about the phones that are available in the jail to people who are there. And if there's call blocking or something like that, they can call someone else. There's no testimony they get one phone call. There's testimony there are phones in the jail.
What about the 24-hour? Looks like that's when you most need a bail bond.
Yes, that is, and that's why there are those 20 to 40 phone calls that are in there. But there's testimony in the record after this rule was passed that the population of the Harris County Jail did not increase. There was not a problem with people getting bondsmen. They simply got them by alternative means. There's also in the jail, the Harris County Jail, posted approved bail bondsmen with phone numbers so that they can call directly. There's the Yellow Pages, there's friends that they can call, and the fact of the matter is, bottom line, more people did not have to stay in jail for a longer period of time, according to what we have in the record.
Mr. Becker, what does the record reflect about how robust and competitive the bail bond industry is in Harrison County?
There's 82 bail bondsmen, Your Honor, and if there's the biggest red herring in this case is the anti-competitive, allegedly, nature of this, there is evidence in the record that about the time these rules were passed and enforced, Mr. Pruitt was the third biggest bail bondsman of 82 in terms of bonds written, seventh biggest in terms of total liability. My clients, you remember, are not really bail bondsmen. They're insurance company who underwrite the bail bondsmen. And they had 16 or 26, I don't remember, bail bondsmen in Harris County that they underwrite. And if you look at that list on the big chart, they go from the top to the bottom. Mr. Pruitt is much more a big guy than we are.
How many bail bondsmen were there before 2001? Do you know?
No, sir, I just know
there were rules were promulgated.
2001, March of 2001.
The evidence that you are reciting was all created post-promulgation of these rules, right?
No, ma'am, I do not agree with that. I certainly do not agree with that. I don't agree with the cases that he cites on page 33 of his brief where he says they stand for the proposition, by the way, that it has to be pre-promulgation. Those cases don't say that. And, in fact, in the Edenfield case, which he cites, they did consider post-promulgation evidence and just rejected it on the merits. But I think, this is an important question, as are they all. A lot of this evidence, for example, the nine affidavits, the police officers who testified, they hadn't given sworn testimony to the bail bond board before promulgation, but they verified the information that the bail bond board already had. That's all. They had oral information, oral complaints, and some in writing. And after the fact, we showed there was a valid basis for that concern.
I don't think you heard my second question. Do you know how many bondsmen, or does the record reflect how many bondsmen there were before 2001?
I thought I said I didn't know. At least I don't know. I know that there were 82 at about the time that these regulations were passed, because that's the number on this list that shows who's the big ones and who are the small ones.
Does the record reflect what has happened to bail bond charges and rates since the rules went into effect compared to before they went into effect?
No, sir. That's not. All we know are how the jail population was affected and that the complaints increased.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Beck.
Thank you.
Mr. Furlow.
Your Honor.
Mr. Becker says your pre-promulgation cases are all flawed and that you may have misled the court in citing those.
Well, that's disturbing because the U.S. Supreme Court emphasized in Central Hudson and in other cases, and I can easily give you the exact page citation to those, where they said that it's got to be the state's stated purposes and the, as opposed to rational relationship analysis. This First Amendment analysis requires the state to stick with the stated purposes or its restrictions on our right to speak. And if,
do they have to be stated in advance of the restriction?
Well, the 11th Circuit, summarizing all the cases, said that's what the vast majority of courts do. And we make exceptions, perhaps, for cases on the verge of pornography, because this case concerns bail bonds in speech and writing, not bare breasts and expressive conduct. That's the subject of that, what she referred to as the SOB case in the Fifth Circuit. Those cases that are on the verge of pornography might be analyzed under the existing governmental rationale. That still puts the Fifth Circuit in a tiny minority. But I can easily, Justice Medina, give you those cases where the Supreme Court has said, specifically to page number, that it's got to be the stated rationale that the government has given. Here we don't have pre-enactment or at-enactment statement of purposes. And so I submit to you that all of this post hoc justification created for litigation a year and a half after they passed this enactment is utterly irrelevant to this case. And under the Tinsley Media case from the 11th Circuit, the vast majority of other courts that have dealt with this issue, it is not proper to consider that. And that's where the First Court of Appeals erred in its analysis, despite that matter being briefed too.
What is the status of the Fifth Circuit appeal, in this case, the federal?
All briefing on the merits is complete, and we're waiting to hear from oral argument. So,
waiting to hear about it?
We're waiting to get a date.
Yeah.
Okay. We just completed up the last, I turned in the last brief on September 1. And so, that 11th Circuit case reflects the vast majority of cases. The Second Circuit has said you've got a bare legislative record, restriction falls. They cannot meet their Central Hudson second element of a substantial governmental purpose
on a record created for litigation afterwards. If they were studying it for years, as Mr. Becker tells you, why couldn't they do what ought to be the simple rule here, which is, government, if you're going to study it for years, set forth your purposes at the date you enact it, and set forth the reasons. And that's what the Supreme Court required, and that's how they upheld the restrictions of the State Bar of Florida in the Wentworth case, because there was a 106-page summary of a study that had gone on for 2 years. These folks came out of an executive session with these chock full of exception rules crafted by IFIC's attorney, Mr. Moore, and they did that without any statement of purposes or any explanation of how they had revised the rules that had originally been a flat ban.
Was there more of a statement in connection with the legislature's promulgation of the corresponding statute, 1704?
No. Wonderful story there. That slipped in by IFIC's law office. They slipped it in 2 days before our Democratic legislators fled the legislature in response to the Tom Lane redistricting plan. There was no record of that. I could easily give you the legislative history and look at it yourself. No hearings, no studies, no surveys, no testimony, no nothing except the IFIC people getting the best paid lobbyists to come in there at the last moment when no one was looking and slip this in like a stealth fighter under the radar. And that's how they continually operate. In Harris County Bail Bond Board, in the legislature, on two legislative enactments, they go in under the radar so that no one has an opportunity to oppose their restrictions on people's First Amendment liberties to speak.
Mr. Furlow, you know, I think it would be safe to say that everybody up here is concerned about the safety of police officers. And from what I understand, the record is not... There aren't a number of examples that can tell us how many police officers have been in danger because of this statute. But how do we weigh that, if you keep that in mind, that we're concerned about safety of police officers, with your argument that your client has his First Amendment rights have been infringed, to come up with an answer to that?
I ask you to engage in balancing and studious scrutiny of the record that Chief Justice Roberts engaged in when he submitted an amicus brief in the Greater New Orleans case, which former bail bondsman Representative Michael Kubosch attached to his amicus brief. That shows you how you go about doing it. Here, let me fill in the details that Mr. Becker didn't give you. Zero officers, victims of crime, witnesses throughout the nation have been injured by this. Their Sergeant Carter, the bail bond board, conducted the study for 2 years now trying to find some real-world example of harm and found zero, and that's well evidence in summary judgment.
What about the specific shootout that he referenced in his argument?
In a conclusory DPS affidavit not disclosed in deposition without any facts, any dates, any specific circumstances to which we objected, and then when Judge Casale failed to rule on the extensive summary judgment and the evidentiary objections, we objected to his failure to rule. So there's nothing there. It's pure conclusory. It's just like in the Ramirez versus Greater Volkswagen case. Utter failure to connect the dots by these expert witnesses. What they've got here, Ms. Hachin talks about how these are social matters. These are absolute failures on the part of the board, which has the burden of proof to justify its actions. And that's one of the reasons why the Attorney General refused to defend the constitutionality of these rules or of the corresponding state legislation. He would not defend what he knew to be unconstitutional. And I ask this board to preserve, protect, and defend our constitutional rights by defending us against the bail bond.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.